This episode is sponsored by The Bridge to Recovery, a nonprofit program on 115 acres near Bowling Green, Kentucky, a tranquil place where they've been changing lives for over 40 years. Their people improve their quality of life by acknowledging past emotional wounds and healing from all forms of trauma. The CEO, Paul Hamlin, has been a friend of mine for 20 years. Call him directly at 858-945-7848. That's 858-945-7848, or you can learn more about The Bridge to Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting thebridgetorecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Jackie Shannon Hollis, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. You know, if there was no other reason for me to have this podcast, I would do it just so I could have conversations with people like Jackie Shannon Hollis. She's an author, and I had her on the show to talk about her memoir, which was published 6 months ago. It's called This Particular Happiness: A Childless Love Story. It's a beautiful book. She writes about the process that she went through to determine ultimately to not become a parent and her misgivings about that decision. And, you know, I was really impressed with the ease with which she writes so eloquently about her innermost thoughts and feelings. It's something that's difficult to do, especially to come through with the kind of clarity that Jackie does. So this was a great conversation, and just really happy to be able to share this with you all. Jackie Shannon Hollis.
I'm good. It's good to talk to you, Tom.
It's good to talk to you. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And, you know, the closer we got to this and the more I thought about it, the more excited I became to have this conversation with you and to hear more about your memoir, and specifically because I feel like, you know, obviously I'm not a woman, so I don't know what it feels like to be a woman, but I know a lot. I have five sisters, and I've seen many women struggle with that decision of whether or not to become a parent, or am I going to choose between a career and a family? And, you know, that is... It's such a emotionally loaded sort of scenario that women go through, and it has to be extraordinarily difficult unless you're just absolutely sure what you want. And it either is the career or it is to be the mother. But if you're kind of in between or you want both, it's just tough to navigate. Mm-hmm. And so,
and for some people who, you know, by way of infertility are, you know, dealing with it from that side too, they know what they want, but can't have it.
Yeah. So, and, you know, there are aspects of grief mm-hmm. on all sides. You know, there are women who maybe they become pregnant unintentionally at a young age and they're grieving what might have been if they didn't become a mother so young. And then,
that's interesting. I think, you know, when you think, like, thinking about it in that way, there is grief on all sides.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're, and it's not all the same loss, mm-hmm. but it's all,
yeah.
it's all a grieving process. And I've just seen women, I've seen some women, I've had women in my life who have agonized over this, you know, who were really, mostly women who were really invested in their career.
And was their struggle then, they were invested in their career and felt that it would cost them in some way to have a child, even though they wanted one? Or,
well, and, you know, I'm not so sure it wasn't also an element of guilt for not prioritizing becoming a parent. And then, you know, of course, you talk about this in your book with your mother, especially about, you know, they want grandchildren. Yeah. And so especially if you're in a family and you're the only daughter, you know, I've seen that too, where, you know, there's almost a responsibility and they feel like they're doing something wrong. It's an internal struggle.
Mm-hmm. And it is, I mean, I think the part of teasing out what is my own desire and what is coming from outside expectations, what is my body? You know, there's a question, I suppose, about how much of the desire to have children is for women is truly that biological drive. But for me, it felt like that. And so just trying to sort out where is this wanting or longing coming from? It's really complex. And I think it's not, you know, it's not simple. I think the person who has a child, it's hard to go back, although I have heard women say this, that they have regretted that choice. They feel more comfortable, I think, saying that to me than they might say to other people. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've had people who've not had children say they regretted that choice as well. But it's, you know, it is this, for me, it was this ongoing process of trying to figure out where is this thought to have a child, this feeling to have a child coming from. And, you know, that was set against the desire to stay with my husband who didn't want to have children. Mm. And where is that desire to be with him coming from so strongly?
Yeah. Well, and one of the reasons why I was excited to have this conversation with you is where this fits in the whole picture of personal authenticity. Because you're right. Those are the questions. What is it that I really want versus what do I think I want because of some unmet need or whatever it might be that's driving a desire that I may have? You know, our desires don't necessarily always, they're not always grounded in what we want.
No.
For ourselves.
I think, yeah, so much of what we do comes from external, the expectations outside. One young woman who read my book who has children, and so she'd be Gen Y, I think. She said, you know, I had kids. She said, I felt a little bit guilty when I read your book because I had these children without ever really thinking why I was doing that. She said, I just thought it's what you were supposed to do, to get married and then have children. And I think there are many, many things that we do just because it's just sort of set up and built into this story about what your life is supposed to be like. It surprised me to hear that from a younger generation because I know was true in my generation, there were very few other examples of women without children.
Hmm. Well, and this point you're making about it just being maybe a societal norm, it's the same thing with marriage. I think, you know, it's one of the things that I think is a culture where we kind of fall short because we just have this sort of, we operate with this, this assumption that by and large, everyone's supposed to just get married. And, you know, there isn't a written rule about a specific age, but at a certain point, if you haven't done it yet, you start feeling like there's something wrong with you because of the messages that we get and our culture. And, you know, for me, I was a guy who at 27, 28 years old, you know, met my ex-wife and kind of, there was a bit of, well, this is my chance, that here it is. I, you know, and it probably somewhere in there, there was the thought that, you know, there's something wrong with me because this hasn't happened yet. I'm late. I already have friends who have kids and homes and all that stuff. And here I'm still single. And so there was a sense of urgency that in hindsight was completely unnecessary. And I think the other side of both of these things, whether we enter into a marriage without have, you know, when 10 years later in hindsight, we might've done it differently, or the same thing with becoming a parent. It just, it speaks to how, to some degree, I guess we're just powerless to life. We can't control everything.
Oh, yeah.
And things don't always work out the way that they're planned. And that's part of where we garner our wisdom, I think, when we go through these things in life and we learn to adapt. And it makes us more compassionate, hopefully. Or, you know, if you're not emotionally balanced, it might make you bitter, I guess.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, that it's one of the pleasures for me of growing up and growing older is just having that perspective over time of being able to see, you know, this sort of the idea of the weather comes in and the weather goes out, and looking back at things, at decisions I've made, and thinking, huh, that's interesting that I did that. Wouldn't choose that now. But also just knowing, yeah, that things change, we change. I mean, think of over a decade how much a person can change, particularly the ages from the 20s, I think, is a huge time of change. And I think that kids in their early 20s are so definite about this is how life is and how it will be. And then by 30, they have a different story about their life.
Yeah. Yeah. That was probably my most difficult decade. I mean, not in terms of things that were happening, but just not knowing who I was.
Yeah.
It's a tough time because you're kind of an adult, but you really don't know what's going on yet. Yeah. You're trying, you know, you're trying. Uh-huh. It's tough stuff. It really is. Yeah. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your book and how you came to write it. I guess if you read it, which, you know, I've read a portion of it, it's sort of self-explanatory, but for the person who knows nothing about it, what would you say?
Well, the book is about being raised as someone who, in a generation, a family, rural Eastern Oregon family, where everyone I knew, all the women I knew in the small town I grew up in were mothers, and I thought that I would be too someday. It was a thing I just never questioned. And I went through a number of relationships. I married, I divorced, and didn't yet have a child. And then I began to really question whether that was, you know, why is it that I'm just heading in that direction, the idea that I want to have a child. And around that time, I met my husband, Bill. I was about 28. And he was a man who did not want children. And I was really at a point where I thought, yeah, I think my life will be okay without children. And then as the book opens, shortly after we married, I found out from my mother about her great disappointment about me not having children. And her fear that I would end up being a bitter, lonely old woman. And there was something about that particular moment, being with my family and hearing her disappointment, that went into some very deep part of me that I couldn't seem to wrangle back down, of really feeling knowing that I was going to be left out of this club, and that I was going to be disappointing people, and pleasing people was a pretty big thing for me for many years. Mm. Being a good kid, although I also was not a good kid secretively, I was very mixed. So that's really, the book is about this process of being in a relationship that I very much wanted to be in, and how my husband and I navigated that. And then also how it sent me on quite an exploration of, if you don't have this one thing that you think you want, how do I live this life? What kind of life do I want? And how do I make peace with this particular longing? And that's the journey of the book. In a lot of ways, it is about being childless and about sort of the experience of childlessness. But it's also, that's sort of the hat of meaning that it's hung on. But it's really about this, identity and search for self, and about relationship.
Hmm.
All kinds of relationships, mother and daughter, sister, friend, and then my relationship with my husband.
Not
as
to
well
mention,
as my relationship with myself.
Right. That's, which is, where all the rest of them
source from.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I really admire, in listening to you read the book. I want to say it's really hard, I think, to write about oneself in a way that's so transparent and articulate and also very simple and clear. That's what I got. I got clarity, which I really admired, the fact that you could express all these ideas about yourself and your thoughts and your emotions. And, just one line that I wrote down that struck me, and I had a similar thought and experience at one point in my life. I didn't know that the first hot breathlessness wasn't love.
Yeah.
That is such a powerful statement. And it goes back to this idea of, we just don't know what we don't know.
Yeah.
And age and time and the process of living life, we hopefully gain wisdom from that. But, there's not really any way to figure that out besides going through it, right?
Going through it. Uh-huh. Yeah. 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 Because that, that hot breathlessness is pretty exciting, and we kind of want to stick around,
Yeah.
Although the ability to live with that really is sort of unrealistic, to sustain, live with that sustained excitement. But I definitely thought that's what it was supposed to be like, and was raised on, literature of, the literature of romance,
mm-hmm.
and of romantic love. And really, it drove me for a long time, keep continuing to try to find that. And that when it went away, thinking, oh, well, then this isn't love. I don't love this person.
Mm-hmm. Because the intensity doesn't exist or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's another part of our culture where I think a lot of us, most of us, have kind of bought into the fairy tale, mm-hmm. of how marriage is supposed to be, relationships are supposed to be, and we're not as grounded in reality as we could be. And if we were, we would probably be a lot more successful in our relationships, yeah. You know?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, that, because I think people walk around feeling somehow maybe disappointed in their relationship, like, oh, what happened to that early falling in love part, rather than sort of embracing the fact that I see you, this is who you are, and you see me, and we're still here together. I know when Bill and I got together, we both really understood that we'd been through enough relationships by the time we met. And we'd also done sort of different kinds of studying. I had read these books called He, She, and We that really broke down what romantic, you know, like the concept, how romantic love was this thing that was sort of fed to us through various forms of media. And then also understanding that every relationship hits a power struggle when those rose-colored glasses fall away. Mm-hmm. And so we went into it knowing that. So we fully embraced the excitement, the, you know, the breathlessness, knowing that there was going to be this point where that turned. And that settled down, and we would actually see each other and then get to decide, is this where I want to be? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so that's something that sounds really appealing to me, you know, to find someone who sees life clearly enough to know that that's really how this works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To know, okay, so here we are. We obviously have this love for each other, but we, you know, and I think a lot of times I have put pressure on myself by, okay, I have you, you're my partner. By God, I'm going to be with you. Mm-hmm. We've committed to each other. Now we're going to be together. And in doing so, then ignore the little red flags that come up mm-hmm. to signal to me, like, maybe this isn't the best partner for you. And, yeah. And for me, I wouldn't even allow that into my consciousness because I made this commitment.
Right.
And and man, you know, what I know now is I meet someone and we decide we're going to give this a go and see where we are when that honeymoon's over. Mm-hmm. And if at that point we then decide that we don't want to be together, it doesn't mean I'll have any less love for you. The shape of it will just change. It'll be different.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's not the way most people want to look at it. And I think probably a lot of people would have a hard time letting go of the fairy tale. You're so invested in it, you know?
Yeah. I guess because I've been kind of gone through this process, I'm always surprised that it's still out there. You know, that's still going on.
People still do this.
Yeah. And I mean, I understand it. I definitely know there are times where, you know, and I think that's just kind of that, like I'll hear a song that will just really, you know, get some really deep part of me and think, oh yeah, that longing and that sense of being completely fresh and new to someone. Where they just adore, like just completely adore me in this. I just want to know everything about you way. And Bill, I have to say, I do feel adored by Bill, but I also know he's seen all of the rough, dark edges of me. And, you know, sometimes there could just be that longing for the newness and the excitement. And I think no matter how long or how much you know, or how, you know, kind of how wise I might think I am, I still, you know, occasionally have that, oh yeah, I remember that feeling and I liked that feeling.
Mm. Yeah. 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 It's, so the, it, and it really is interesting how these things are roles in romantic relationships are relationship with the idea of parenting, just how deeply embedded they are in who we are as human beings, and how this whole podcast is, you know, sort of based on the idea that if we really just kind of focus on what it is we want from life, you know, we're going to be a lot happier and we're going to be better for the world. And the idea of becoming a parent, there's so many of us. There are a lot of people who, whether they know it or not, whether they mean to or not, and becoming a parent is such a healing process. I think so often it's about someone trying to heal something, trying to find a missing piece.
And I think, you know, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think that we're, you know, in some ways parenting can be a kind of do-over if, you know, for something that, you know, we didn't get in ourselves, as long as we're not kind of trying to live through that child. But it is like, how can I give my child something I didn't have? And if it's a consciousness of, you know, what is it that I didn't have? But I think in the same way about not having the romance about, you know, a love relationship, I think it's just so important to go into parenting. In fact, I think we have almost more of a romance with new parenthood. And yet I've talked to so many new parents who are having, you know, zombies from the lack of sleep and feel that they've lost a sense of themselves in that. So, you know, having them also go into it with, you know, the you know, I know this is going to be a challenge, and that, you know, just that there's a romance there to also be super conscious of. I certainly had a huge romance with the idea of motherhood. Even though I knew logically all of the other realities, I had been around so many people with children, and knew that it could be exhausting. When I would have my, you know, nieces or nephews come stay, I felt that exhaustion, and felt the luxury of being able to, you know, at the end of the weekend, wave goodbye.
Right. Yeah, that's a big deal. That's a big deal. But, you know, there is also, we get sucked into these fantasies of what our relationships with our children are going to be like, you know, the imagery of what that's going to look like. And, you know, there was, I love baseball, and a lot of my childhood, my happiest moments in childhood were on the baseball diamond. And so, you know, I always figured I'd have a little boy, man, I'm going to teach him how to play baseball. We're going to play catch. I'm going to be able to. And, you know, I have a 13-year-old boy who, you know, athletically, he could probably do just about anything. I mean, he's not tall enough to dunk a basketball, but he's agile and athletic. But he was just never drawn to it. And, you know, a time, you know, I thought he would be. We sign him up for T-ball and all that. And I did the coaches training, and I was going to be a coach when he was a 4-year-old. And we went to one game, and, you know, he just wasn't into it. And, you know, he had his reasons. He wanted to be home with his sisters, and, you know, he was a little shy about going out and putting himself out there in that way at that age. It was a quick learning experience for me that the bottom line is, it's not about me. That's the thing that I think a lot of people forget. And I have to remind myself sometimes as a dad. Someone said to me one time, you know, they're not our kids, they're God's kids.
Yeah.
And we're here.
I heard someone say that too. I think it's a really nice reminder.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Tom, when I think about this, you know, because I think a lot of parents go through that struggle that, you know, regardless of how conscious or aware you are, you have sort of these expectations of an experience you're going to share with your child. So given that, say he didn't want to play ball, baseball, what do you think the experience you were looking for? You know, that's a question I would be like, what was the experience that I was hoping to have with my child in that? And what other ways am I getting that?
Well, you know, I think ultimately, with the benefit of a decade or so of time and therapy and and lots of work on myself and self-examination, you know, I'm the youngest of eight kids. I had great parents, but you know, my dad was 50 when I was born, and there were eight of us, you know? So yeah. I probably played catch with him twice. And so when I learned how to fish, it was another kid's dad who taught me how to fish. And there were, I found other people, neighbors and other people I had an older brother who I sought that sort of attention with, but, ultimately, I think the honest, real truth is that, you know, that was what I was trying to resolve, you know, that I wanted to be the kind of dad for a child that I didn't get to have. And, you know, the good news is, I have been. It just didn't look like I thought it was going to look, you know, I mean, and none of that takes away from how I feel about my dad or what a great dad he was. I mean, you know, there's no blame or anything like that. It just is what it is. But it has ultimately made me a better dad probably. You know, because I made a point to be present.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And, you know, but they're kids. They don't always appreciate that either. You know, I mean, it's like,
no,
they're still kids. You know,
I have a nephew that I hang out with once a week who's eight now, well, almost eight. And, it's a constant process for me of, letting go of my idea of how this time should be and, you know, figuring and, you know, what, you know, looking at my own expectations and then getting, you know, letting go of those. 'Cause then I get to be surprised about whatever happens.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and see, for me, the added element to it is I have a responsibility to raise this, you know, so to make sure that the homework gets done and that I teach him this and that, and, you know, and, what I've, you know, a lesson that I've learned recently is that, you know, sometimes I just need to take a breath and just enjoy being with my son and not worry about all the other stuff. Mm-hmm. Just relax. Which just can be hard for me to do. And it can be especially hard for us to do that when, you know, there are so many emotional implications, like when it comes to, you know, filling that need that I, that unmet need, you know, I will say that I've learned more about myself by becoming a dad probably than any other way.
Yeah, and you know, the thing for me, I totally get that, and I think that I bet most parents would say that. What's interesting for me is I think I learned more about myself, grew more than I may have, or in a different way at least, but by not becoming a parent.
Mm-hmm.
By pursuing this different path that pushed me in some ways that So I really get like what people come up against as parents and how you have to sort of face yourself all of the time and face in some way the awareness that no matter what, I'm gonna screw this up in one way or another. Mm. My kid's gonna have right. a resentment right. against me. But as a non-parent, there are so many things that I've come up against just in choosing something different and having to kind of not be part of the, you know, the regular crowd of, mm-hmm. of parents. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's been difficult socially?
Well,
more than anything?
I would say it's, you know, socially I'm pretty comfortable with kind of all kinds of people, and I've been around a lot of people who've had kids. So not so much, I haven't ever really felt excluded in any overt way. But I also think that I worked really hard to fit in with the parenting crowd. Because I knew a lot about babies. And so I was able to go to a baby shower or be with a group of people and of women who, you know, were talking about their kids, and to just be like, well, you know what, this is what the conversation is going to be like. And I can either be resentful about that or feel left out, or I can join the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't really, I wouldn't say hard. There are times where it seemed one-dimensional when, you know, that was all of the conversation. And I think when people have young children, it can be all of the conversation. And so, you know, I don't think I lacked socially in any way, but I don't think I was excluded from anything because I wasn't someone who was bitter in any overt way about my childlessness. I think people who have children can also often be pretty unaware of what people who don't have children might be dealing with, particularly people who are childless by infertility.
Mm-hmm.
Are often those, you know, that group of people are often really suffering and feeling very alone in that, because, you know, everyone else is celebrating motherhood and this woman is not getting to have that, and she really wanted to.
Hmm. Yeah. Back to the loss.
Yeah. 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 There is the loss in that. You know, I think the thing about loss or grief is I think no matter what we choose, whatever kind of life there is, that we're not choosing something else. I mean, I once thought that I would, you know, was really interested in doing deep sea diving. You know, I didn't do that in my life,
mm-hmm.
You know, or whatever. I mean, just all, there's so many possible lives we can live.
Mm-hmm.
And by saying yes to one, we're saying no to 100 others. But for me, it's about really saying, this is the one that I want to be in. This is the one I'm choosing. And sort of imagining those other parallel lives going on without me being fully in them.
Well, I can imagine, you know, the years that I've spent, you know, raising my son and, you know, the attention that demands, especially when they're really little. Because,
yeah.
Like, a lot of times those conversations are really difficult to have because you get a few words in and then here they are again. And then there are no conversations. When I think about that time, what else could I have done with that time? I could have pursued a academic career of some kind, or I could have, you know, there are any number of things that could have happened. And I think, you know, one of the traps as a culture that we fall in is if you're not a parent, then that's something that's missing, something you're missing out on, when in reality, you know, maybe you got to do something really, really great because of how you invested that resource of your time.
Yeah.
Because it is demanding to be a parent. And so I hear you when you say that you went in another direction and all of that, you invested that in something else.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this idea, you know, I mean, I really do think that there is, you know, it's a, you know, you'd call it a pronatalist, you know, society that we're in, and the idea that parenting is the ultimate joy. And I do not dispute at all that it's an incredible joy. I mean, I see that. It's a lot of work, too. And yet, but the idea sort of there's something to be pitied or something sad or that people don't have children or selfish, you know, all of these things are, those are the things that I felt kind of the biggest struggle about was just the kinds of judgments. Oh, she couldn't have children, or she didn't want children, and the kind of the loading on of judgment about that. Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of person is that? Because it, somehow we have this narrow band that, you know, to want to be a mother is really the only way for a woman to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, you know, there's a large group of child-free people who, women who are, never wanted children are very clear about it and are having a stronger voice now about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are seeing that more and more, but that judgment that you're talking about, that's something that I was going to ask you about because, you know, I'm a single guy at this point. You know, I had a colleague of mine, I was talking to him about this woman who I was dating, and you know, he's asking me questions about her, and you know, she doesn't have any kids, and you know, I mean, he literally said, well, you know, a woman that age, if she doesn't have kids and she can have kids, you know, you gotta kind of want, you know, there's something there, Tom. You know, I mean, like that's so, I imagine you have experienced some of that judgment in your life. I don't know how you could avoid it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I had a thing happen here last June. I was at a Library Association meeting in Washington, D.C., right before my book came out. And there was sharing advanced reader copies of my book. And there's a man who came, an older man who came up to the table. And I said, oh, you know, would you be interested in advanced reader copy? And I talked to him a little bit about the book, and he just looked at me and he says, I've met women like you, women who didn't get what they want. And I pointed out, you know, the word happiness on the cover of the book. And I said, I really think you need to read this book. But it was this really sort of, much laden kind of thing that somehow is bitter or unhappy. And that is something that I really rail against, because anyone who knows me personally knows that I am and have always been an incredibly joyful, playful, happy person. Even at times when I was struggling, there was this sense of, you know, of joy in me.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've always had access to, you know, sort of all of the feelings. And so what has been more, I think what I've gotten more, that was a kind of a one-off experience. I haven't had a lot of things other than people saying, well, you wouldn't know because you're not a mom, or people who say, well, as a mother, I understand, you know, some tragedy may be happening, some child, something that happened to a child, and a person will say, well, as a mother, I really feel this deeply, as if someone who isn't a mother can't feel deeply a tragedy that happens to a child.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's the kinds of things that are some of the exclusionary kinds of language that can happen. I've had deep relationships with so many kids in my life, and I have loved them unconditionally. So I'm always surprised at this idea that just because I don't have children, I don't know the capacity to love children.
Mm. Yeah. And that's something that you hear a lot before you become a parent from other people about. It's like this brand of love that you don't get to experience unless you become a parent. Yeah. And, you know, looking back on the moment that I did become a parent, like I expected something, you know, I expected it to feel a certain way. And like, I didn't think it would be subtle. Of course there was joy, you know, but what I did experience that it didn't, you know, it wasn't like a lightning bolt or anything like that. It hit me over the course of a couple hours after my son was born. You know, it wasn't this overpowering feeling of love as much as, of course, that was there, but not in the way, the dramatic way that you would think, the way people present it to you before you. I mean, you know, well, you'll just never know until you become a parent. You know, that type of talking down your nose sort of statement.
But what I did
experience is a sense of completion.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Like my, you know, if I died now, you know, like I did something. And it was the first time I ever really felt that.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's even that sort of deep sense of, you know, of procreating, you know, that you know, I think we are, you know, we are still animals, and that need to, on a deeply unconscious level, it's got to feel quite complete to.
Yeah. On an instinctive level. Yeah.
But I also, you know, I think, and cause I have heard that, and, you know, a lot, and I think that we are fed this idea, you know, the movie births of, you know, the immediate love that happens. I think some people do feel that, but I think a lot of people, it's so much more of a slow burn. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of men who don't really fall in love with their children until they become more relational. Mm-hmm. You know, the infants, you know, they don't have that as deep a connection. It takes a while for that, you know, that to build. And I also know there's, you know, I really feel like, you know, the relationship I've had with my husband is something that I don't think a lot of people have had the experience of. But it's so, you know, it's also immeasurable.
Yeah.
You know, how do you know? I mean, how do you measure love?
Mm-hmm. Well, I know, in terms of couples, there, you know, there are just some guys you meet, and the way that they talk about their wives or their partners, it's just different. You know, it's entirely apparent that they're best friends. There is no cynicism or very little. And there's a sense of reverence that is observable. You know, you can see it. And, that's if I'm going to be with somebody, that's what I want.
Yeah.
But, and I think, you know, if there's a way that it's supposed to be, that's probably the way that it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of us, I think, because we don't know who we are and we don't know what we want, you know, we kind of settle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the next thing you know, our lives became something like we never pictured that they would be. And, you know, middle age sets in and this isn't what I wanted. So, and a lot of people do get bitter, I think. Mm-hmm. And so, to me, that's where this, the cynicism on the part of men about their wives, to me, that's where that really comes from.
Yeah.
You know, cause even having been divorced,
I have seen some couples who have, you know, my parents were an interesting example of this. They got married when they were 18 and 19. And you know, pretty quickly had four kids and then a fifth one when they were in their early 30s. And my dad was an alcoholic and drank for a number of years. And, you know, their relationship didn't look super great for a lot of years, but Dad was sober for the last 20 some years of his life. And it was such a pleasure to see how them find each other again. And in a way, that time when he was drinking, my mom kind of went off and found her own self in different ways through art and work and doing all kinds of creative things as well as, I mean, she started an ambulance, rural ambulance crew in our small county. And by the end of Dad's life, I would say that Mom and him had quite a sweet love going. They had, you know, I've seen some couples go around and find each other again later. And Dad, I think, had that. He had both a reverence and an irreverence for Mom.
Yeah.
I think, you know, they it kind of sat side by side. It was, but he did adore her and always was her fan.
Yeah. That's nice. That's nice to hear. And, you know, where, you know, through his alcoholism, your mom, out of survival, probably kept herself busy, found things to do, and had all this whole aspect of her life that may not have existed had he been present in a different way. And then because they stuck it out, you know, they circle back later on, and that's really cool.
Yeah, it was interesting to see. And, as you know, I mean, she never did Al-Anon, he never did AA, but they really did a lot of that process of recovering in different ways, because she basically said, "I'm staying, but I'm going to live my life. I'm not leaving." And she did that and stopped trying to change him.
Yeah. Wow. That's remarkably healthy for a person to do without,
you know, without any. She really did it. And he, you know, in his sobriety, it was quite healing also, because seeing him become a grandfather in a way that he hadn't as much been as a father. I mean, he was around quite a bit when I was quite little, but then was his drinking took much more of his, took him away a lot more. And so, but watching him as a grandfather, he had 7 grandkids, and he just adored those kids, and he showed up for everything. And they were out at his, you know, out at the house a lot. And so there was something really healing for all of us in that as well. So sometimes I think sticking around, while it can be pretty rough along the way, it seemed to work out for them.
Well, so this book, Jackie, if there's a particular audience who you had in mind when you wrote it, who was it?
Well, I'd like to say everyone, but I would definitely say people who like to read a story of a journey to sort of searching for yourself and meaning, and people who are interested in relationships. And I definitely think that it's something for both parents and non-parents. I've had a number of people who are parents say how helpful it's been for them to both looking at their own decisions around becoming parents, as well as their understanding of the people in their lives who do not have children, particularly the women in their lives who don't have children, and that they've engaged in conversations with them differently than they ever had before, and sort of honored them a little bit differently. So I think people who are interested in, you know, self-examination, self-exploration, I think there'll be things in the book for them. And it's a story. I mean, there's a, you know, I think it has a pretty good arc. I follow 3 threads. I also go into looking at trying to understand my husband by going back and looking at his own childhood and, you know, what the, you know, what does that mean in terms of who he, why he didn't want to have children.
So I'll tell you, so I found you on Instagram, and a post that Cheryl Strayed did. Yeah. So, and it was, I love her, first of all, you know, and, but it was basically, you know, you got to read these books, and I'm not just doing this because I don't do that. I only say that when I really mean it. And so there, kind of, you know, what I mean? It had all this, but I thought, man, that's how I decided that I wanted to reach out to you. So how'd that happen?
Well, so Cheryl, I live in Portland, Oregon, and she's a writer in the local community. And I had met her once before Wild and Tiny Beautiful, before she was known as Dear Sugar, and before Wild came out. Right before it, I'd gone to a reading. She was reading in a pub, and we had an interaction. And then we just sort of, you know, loosely, followed around Facebook, loosely knew each other in this great, big, huge literary community that I'm a part of here in Portland. And so when I was getting ready to ask for blurbs for my book, I reached out to her. And she was at a point that I had heard that she wasn't reading, you know, doing that much anymore. But she agreed. She said, yes, I'll read it. And then she wrote this blurb. And so when the book came out, it was the same day as Renee Denfeld's book, The Child Finder, came out, she's another Portland author. And she did that tweet, and it was pretty fabulous of her to do that.
Yeah.
She just, yeah, I mean, it really, or that post on, I guess, was where she put it. But anyway, it was, yeah, it was on Instagram. It was just really exciting to have her be that generous. And she is an incredibly generous person. I think she gets a lot of asks, and she has to set boundaries on a lot of that. But so I felt really grateful that she did what she did.
Well, it got my attention for sure. And I'm glad I, you know, followed that little thread and found my way.
I am too.
Yeah. So, if you go back to a younger you, you know, what would you say? When would be the time when she most needed to your support, or, and what is the wisdom that you would impart to younger Jackie?
You know, it's such an interesting question, because my first thought is the younger Jackie probably wouldn't have listened. and there are so many things that I look back now, just even in terms of my body image, like, just love yourself, you're okay. That it took me a lot of years to understand. I would say probably the moment where I most would have needed the advice of the older Jackie was, there was a time, and this, I've written about this a little bit in the book, because it's a thread that weaves through this whole thing about my relationships and about choices I make, and a sense of death being on my left shoulder as I was assaulted, sexually assaulted. And there was a time where I thought I was going to die. And mostly knowing, letting her know that she was going to be okay. And sorry, I get a little teary about this.
No.
That it would be okay to let other people help her. My instinct back then was to, I'm going to stand up and carry on and be tough and not let this hurt me. Mm. And of course, it has an impact no matter what. Mm. And it took me years to really understand what the impact was. And I needed to protect myself on all these levels, but I think I went so overboard with being tough and strong that it's only now that I really understand how just the value of letting people in. That I don't have to have it all together.
Yeah. That's a tough one, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, in the book, I mean, when you told your mom, I mean, basically what you said is I'm okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I, what stood out to me about her response is, man, I don't know how your dad's going to take this. Yeah. And I thought, well, that wasn't the best thing for her to say to her daughter who was just assaulted, you know? And we do, like, we do instinctively respond to these things, and we're protecting ourselves too, you know?
And that was the part that was hardest to understand, was that that was so much, in a way, me protecting myself from how bad this was.
Right.
You know, it's like, nope, I'm not going to let this be bad enough that I have to have help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and it's another one of those examples where life happens, and not even necessarily the event, but the way that we respond to them, you know, just our psyches protecting our themselves. And, and then, you know, the process of, I assume what you've had to do is experience those emotions that you repressed. Because we do carry this stuff in our bodies, you know?
And really, I mean, truly, it's been a, you know, an unfolding over 40 years of, you know, of having that happen. And, you know, I think that that's a thing that I find so fascinating, and is something that I do say to younger people, no matter what they're going through, is that you'll have an understanding of this now. You'll have an understanding of it in 3 years, and 5 years, and 10 years. You know, whether it's, you know, a death of someone, or an end of a relationship, or, you know, assault, whatever it is, I think that we, you know, we keep taking it out and looking at it in different ways, whether we want to or not. It opens up, and you know, if we're willing to just keep, you know, being interested in it, and create safe spaces to do that.
Well, I know for me, well, and safe spaces, and go to safe people too, the people we choose to talk to.
Yeah. Yes.
But I've come to believe that probably, you know, the difficult experiences I've had in life, I've probably done more harm to myself by judging myself for being sad or upset, or, you know, because we have the feeling, and for me, oftentimes it was sadness, and then try to repress it, you know, or just ignore it and live in an alternate reality. But then when I would feel it, be ashamed for feeling it. Yeah. I mean, it, you know, it just pile on and make it worse. And, and, you know, what I, you know, want to teach my son and try to teach other people and try to do myself is just whatever it is, experience it and stop trying to resist it. Now that doesn't mean it's not always convenient to have a meltdown. You know, so maybe I need to hold it together for a few hours until I can be with that supportive person or be by myself and let the tears fall. But, you know, and I think specifically with men, that's one of the places where we've missed the mark over the generations, where it's not about not feeling the emotion. What we really need to do is compartmentalize it and, it, you know, experience it at the appropriate time and the appropriate place among the right people. And what that has turned into, and in most cases with men, is don't feel, you know?
I'm struck by how often, you know, when I'll see a man cry, women do this too, but just they'll cry and say, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and and I'm not gonna cry, you know, or I'm gonna be a big girl or big boy, and I'm not gonna cry. Well, why not? You need to cry.
Why not? Yeah. I know. I had been seeing a therapist up until about a year ago. That she, just the exploration with her about really just accepting whatever the feelings I have, because it's that immediate sense of jumping in and judging them versus, oh yeah, I feel, irritated right now, or I feel judgmental right now, or I feel, ashamed, whatever it is. But it's that desire to drive away, to just judge the feeling. And so it's been really powerful for me to just go, yep, that's, I am feeling controlling right now. I'm, or I'm being, whatever it is. Yeah, I am doing that, rather than denying what in fact I'm doing.
Right. Well, it's a more mindful approach that, if you just observe it and not judge it, and, and it's more loving just to accept yourself, that we're not perfect. We are, we're not always, we're going to be rough around the edges. We're going to be shitty to people sometimes. And, Well, this has been great.
Yeah.
I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. I feel like we jumped right in and went real deep, real fast.
Yeah.
And I love that. That's what I love about this podcast, because I feel like we just need more depth in the world. And, so I've really enjoyed your book.
I appreciate that you're out there creating this, opportunity for people to talk and listen in a deeper way, because I'm all over that. I think it's great.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And to me, it's, one of the things, and you and I talked before we really started recording, about the world of addiction treatment. And for many years, I've kind of had one foot in and one foot out. And as I get to know myself and kind of figure out why, and what I've come to realize is what has really bothered me about it over the years is that, we're talking about all these approaches to stop the individual addiction, and, or should we do this or should we do that? Or what's the best way, or my ways, I did it this way, so that's the right way. Or, how long should you be sober before you sponsor someone? All this stuff. And in my head all along, I've thought, when are we going to do something to put an end to this? Because this isn't the problem. The substance isn't the problem. The problem is that, well, to me, the problem is that, this culture that we live in, we're numbing ourselves en masse. And it's not just substances. It's in some ways, it's probably TV or sports, or of course there's gambling and sex addiction, and but really just avoidance of ourselves. Yeah. And I think if there's one gift of this coronavirus that we're experiencing, it's forcing us to be with ourselves and take a look at ourselves. And so this podcast, this whole Path to Authenticity thing, it's my small attempt to try to, take a little bit of a stab at the bigger problem. If we all had a little more meaning and were more fulfilled, we wouldn't want to numb ourselves.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think this time right now will be an interesting one for exploring that.
Absolutely. It's going to be an opportunity. Solitude. It's going to be an opportunity for a lot of good if we, if we accept it. But Jackie, I really appreciate this. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome. And if you, any of those other Portland authors out there who you think would want to be on the podcast, please let me know. Okay.
I will. That's great.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Good job. You didn't hang up. One thing
I didn't know if you wanted me to or not.
No, I always forget to do that. I need to put that in my little description. I'm going to say goodbye, but don't hang up.
I do want to say your preparation on this is really amazing. I mean, having the guest overview is really, really nice.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And it didn't come right away. I mean, I haven't had it for that long, but it does make it easier for people. And one of the things that I've had to consider and kind of talking this through with some people who I trust is the benefit of that is a lot of people aren't, you know, they're not going to be as comfortable as you are having their voice recorded talking about themselves. So if there's a way to kind of get rid of the mystery a little bit and give them something to hold on to, that's good. That it helps with that, but I appreciate it from you, because you've done a podcast too.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I'm going to listen to. So that when I saw that, that's why she's got a headset and a microphone. Probably.
Actually, I got that because my Yuvi Zalko, who is the person who's original his podcast, I just jumped in on a couple seasons. He doesn't even do it anymore either. He's on to other things. But we had the big fancy ones, but it was so much fun. I loved it, and you know, we did a lot of editing and playing around. I mean, we were definitely amateurs. We did two seasons, and the second one is even more compelling just because of, you know, we follow this one couple, three people in relationship. But it's pretty, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. Time. Yeah. And this has been like kind of my path to authenticity too, because, I've always written, I've just never been one who felt like, you know, so many people just feel like it's so difficult. And I think a lot of times it's just us people telling themselves that, because in truth, we're really all writing all the time. I mean, every conversation, you know, we're always composing something, stringing our thoughts together. And you know, I was on my high school radio station. I'll give you the abbreviated version of this. I always wanted to be in radio when I was a kid. I loved music and grew up where there was great morning radio. And, so we had this high school radio station. You could do it sophomore, junior, senior years. So I was on it my sophomore year, and I always took every journalism class that I could find. So I was in this journalism class also my sophomore year, where it involved a lot of writing. And it was the teacher who was also the advisor for the school newspaper and yearbook. And he grabbed me by the arm one day. He saw me in the hallway and he pulled me into his classroom. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "You're going to be a sports writer." I'm going to be on the radio, you know. And he hands me an application for the school newspaper. And I said, "No, I don't, you know, I'm going to be on the radio station." And he said, "Well, as long as you're doing something in the media." So then that spring, the radio tower was struck by lightning. And by the next school year, they didn't have the money to replace it. So they didn't replace it. There was no radio station. So I ended up on the school newspaper, and it was this fantastic newspaper program at this high school. And he was really great. And he ended up helping me get a job at the local daily newspaper after high school. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But I never really went back to radio. And then, you know, I started doing this blog a little bit. I like writing memoir type personal essay stuff myself. And I started toying with that a little bit, and I knew I needed to get some content out. And I thought, well, I'm going to start writing about people, and maybe I'll write about artists. And I interviewed this artist a couple different times. I sat down with her and recorded the interview, and I kept telling myself, you know, you got to write that. and months go by, and I, every now and then I'll think, man, I'm, you know, feel bad about myself for not writing that yet. Uh-huh. And at one point, you know, I had had this friend who said to me once, you know, have you ever thought about doing a podcast? And it took me a while to connect the dots, but, and I started to become open to that idea, but I didn't know what I would do with it. And then, you know, I'm agonizing over, I should write this. And then finally it hit me. I don't want to write it. I want to talk. I want to have a, you know, so yeah. That's when it all kind of coalesced and that's came great. Together. Wow. And I really enjoy it. I do. I like the impromptu nature of it. Sometimes guests have a little bit of a hard time with that because they want to see it as an interview. And, well, can you give me a list of the questions you're going to ask? And I'm like, well, you know, I really just want to have a conversation and let's see where it goes. I've never had a terrible one.
Well, and I like that. I mean, I that's something that I've enjoyed about listening to your podcast. It's just that it is a conversation, because I think a lot of times, particularly as an author, it can just be like kind of going over the same territory. Mm-hmm. If there are, you know, if it's just about the book, but if it's about sort of the bigger picture, I think it's more interesting.
Yeah. Well, so I take it that's how you see this conversation. It was about the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Good. Then mission accomplished. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks, right. Tom.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice.
did great, honeybee.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.